He had a small frame, and his flesh was dried up on his bones. What was there to decay? It must be a sign from heaven, others hastened to add, and their opinion was adopted at once without protest. For it was pointed out, too, that if the decomposition had been natural, as in the case of every dead sinner, it would have been apparent later, after a lapse of at least 24 hours. But this premature corruption was in excess of nature, and so the finger of God was evident. It was meant for a sign. This conclusion seemed irresistible. Gentle Father Yosef, the librarian, a great favourite of the dead man's, tried to reply to some of the evil speakers that this is not held everywhere alike, and that the incorruptibility of the bodies of the just was not a dogma of the Orthodox Church, but only an opinion, and that even in the most orthodox regions, at Athos, for instance, they were not greatly confounded by the smell of corruption, and there the chief sign of the glorification of the saved was not bodily incorruptibility, but the colour of the bones when the bodies have lain many years in the earth and have decayed in it. And if the bones are yellow as wax, that is the great sign that the Lord has glorified the dead saint. If they are not yellow but black, it shows that God has not deemed him worthy of such glory. That is the belief in Athos, a great place, where the Orthodox doctrine has been preserved from of old, unbroken, and in its greatest purity, said Father Yosef in conclusion. But the meek father's words had little effect, and even provoked a mocking retort. That's all pedantry and innovation, no use listening to it, the monks decided. We stick to the old doctrine, there are all sorts of innovations nowadays. Are we to follow them all? Added others. We have had as many holy fathers as they had. There they are among the Turks. They've forgotten everything. Their doctrine has long been impure, and they have no bells even. The most sneering added. Father Yosef walked away grieving, the more since he'd put forward his own opinion with little confidence, as though scarcely believing in it himself. He foresaw with distress that something very unseemly was beginning, and that there were positive signs of disobedience. Little by little, all the sensible monks were reduced to silence, like Father Yosef, and so it came to pass that all who loved the elder and had accepted with devout obedience the institution of the eldership were all at once terribly cast down and glanced timidly in one another's faces when they met. Those who were hostile to the institution of elders, as a novelty, held up their heads proudly. There was no smell of corruption from the late elder Varsanofi, but a sweet fragrance, they recalled malignantly. But he gained that glory not because he was an elder, but because he was a holy man. And this was followed by a shower of criticism and even blame of Father Zosima. His teaching was false. He taught that life is a great joy and not a vale of tears, said some of the more unreasonable. He followed the fashionable belief he did not recognize material fire in hell. Others, still more unreasonable, added. He was not strict in fasting, allowed himself sweet things, ate cherry jam with his tea. Ladies used to send it to him. Is it for a monk of strict rule to drink tea? Could be heard among some of the envious. He sat in pride, the most malignant declared vindictively. He considered himself a saint, and he took it as his due when people knelt before him. He abused the sacrament of confession, the fiercest opponents of the institution of elders added in a malicious whisper. And among these were some of the oldest monks, strictest in their devotion, genuine ascetics, who had kept silent during the life of the deceased elder, but now suddenly unsealed their lips. And this was terrible, for their words had great influence on young monks who were not yet firm in their convictions. The monk from Obdorsk heard all this attentively, heaving deep sighs and nodding his head. Yes, clearly Father Ferapont was right in his judgment yesterday. And at that moment Father Ferapont himself made his appearance, as though on purpose to increase the confusion. I have mentioned already that he rarely left his wooden cell by the apiary. He was seldom even seen at church, and they overlooked this neglect on the ground of his craziness, and did not keep him to the rules binding on all the rest. But if the whole truth is to be told, they hardly had a choice about it. For it would have been discreditable to insist on burdening with the common regulations so great an ascetic, who prayed day and night, even dropped asleep on his knees. If they had insisted, the monks would have said, He is holier than all of us, and he follows a rule harder than ours. And if he does not go to church, it's because he knows when he ought to. He has his own rule. It was to avoid the chance of these sinful murmurs Father Ferapont was left in peace. As everyone was aware, Father Ferapont particularly disliked Father Zosima, and now the news had reached him in his hut that God's judgment is not the same as man's, and that something had happened which was in excess of nature. It may well be supposed that among the first to run to him with the news was the monk from Obdorsk, who had visited him the evening before, and left his cell terror-stricken. I have mentioned above that though Father Paisi, standing firm and immovable reading the gospel over the coffin, could not hear nor see what was passing outside the cell, he gauged most of it correctly in his heart, for he knew the men surrounding him well. He was not shaken by it, but awaited what would come next without fear, watching with penetration and insight for the outcome of the general excitement. Suddenly, an extraordinary uproar in the passage, in open defiance of decorum, burst on his ears. The door was flung open, and Father Ferapont appeared in the doorway. Behind him there could be seen accompanying him a crowd of monks, together with many people from the town. They did not, however, enter the cell, but stood at the bottom of the steps, waiting to see what Father Ferapont would say or do. For they felt, with a certain awe, in spite of their audacity, that he had not come for nothing. Standing in the doorway, Father Ferapont raised his arms, and under his right arm the keen, inquisitive little eyes of the monk from Obdorsk peeped in. He alone, in his intense curiosity, could not resist running up the steps after Father Ferapont. The others, on the contrary, pressed further back in sudden alarm when the door was noisily flung open. Holding his hands aloft, Father Ferapont suddenly roared, "Casting out, I cast out!" And turning in all directions, he began at once making the sign of the cross at each of the four walls and four corners of the cell, in succession. All who accompanied Father Ferapont immediately understood his action, for they knew he always did this wherever he went, and that he would not sit down or say a word till he'd driven out the evil spirits. "Satan, go hence! Satan, go hence!" he repeated at each sign of the cross. "Casting out, I cast out!" he roared again. He was wearing his coarse gown, girt with a rope. His bare chest, covered with grey hair, could be seen under his hempen shirt. His feet were bare. As soon as he began waving his arms, the cruel irons he wore under his gown could be heard clanking. Father Paisi paused in his reading, stepped forward, and stood before him waiting. "What have you come for, worthy father? Why do you offend against good order? Why do you disturb the peace of the flock?" he said at last, looking sternly at him. "What have I come for, you ask? Why? What is your faith?" shouted Father Ferapont crazily. "I've come here to drive out your visitors, the unclean devils. I've come to see how many have gathered here while I've been away. I want to sweep them out with a birch broom."
"You cast out the evil spirit, but perhaps you're serving him yourself?" Father Paisi went on fearlessly. "And who can say of himself I am holy? Can you, father?"
"I am unclean, not holy. I would not sit in an armchair and would not have them bow down to me as an idol," thundered Father Ferapont. "Nowadays folk destroy the true faith. The dead man, your saint," he turned to the crowd, pointing with his finger to the coffin, "did not believe in devils. He gave medicine to keep off the devils, and so they have become as common as spiders in the corners. And now he has begun to stink himself. In that we see a great sign from God."
The incident he referred to is this. One of the monks was haunted in his dreams, and later on, in waking moments, by visions of evil spirits. When, in the utmost terror, he confided this to Father Zosima, the elder had advised continual prayer and rigid fasting. But when that was of no use, he advised him, while persisting in prayer and fasting, to take a special medicine. Many persons were shocked at the time and wagged their heads as they talked over it. And most of all Father Ferapont, to whom some of the censorious had hastened to report this extraordinary counsel on the part of the elder.
"Go away, Father," said Father Paisi in a commanding voice. "It's not for man to judge, but for God.
Perhaps we see her a sign, which neither you nor I nor any one of us is able to comprehend. Go, father, and do not trouble the flock," he repeated impressively.
"He did not keep the fasts according to the rule, and therefore the sign has come. That is clear, and it's a sin to hide it."
The fanatic, carried away by a zeal that outstripped his reason, would not be quieted.
He was seduced by sweetmeats. Ladies brought them to him in their pockets. He sipped tea, he worshipped his belly, filling it with sweet things, and his mind with haughty thought. And for this he is put to shame.
You speak lightly, father. Father Paisi, too, raised his voice. I admire your fasting and severities, but you speak lightly like some frivolous youth, fickle and childish. Go away, father, I command you.
Father Paisi thundered in conclusion.
I will go,
said Ferapont, seeming somewhat taken aback, but still as bitter.
You learned men, you are so clever, you look down upon my humbleness. I came hither with little learning, and here I have forgotten what I did know. God himself has preserved me in my weakness from your subtlety.
Father Paisi stood over him, waiting resolutely. Father Ferapont paused, and suddenly leaning his cheek on his hand despondently, pronounced in a sing-song voice, looking at the coffin of the dead elder.
Tomorrow they will sing over him, our helper and defender. A splendid anthem, and over me when I die all they'll sing will be, what earthly joy, a little canticle.
He added with tearful regret,
you are proud and puffed up, this is a vain place.
He shouted suddenly like a madman, and with a wave of his hand he turned quickly and quickly descended the steps. The crowd awaiting him below wavered, some followed him at once and some lingered, for the cell was still open. And Father Paisi, following Father Ferapont onto the steps, stood watching him. But the excited old fanatic was not completely silenced. Walking 20 steps away, he suddenly turned towards the setting sun, raised both his arms, and as though someone had cut him down, fell to the ground with a loud scream.
My God has conquered! Christ has conquered the setting sun!
He shouted frantically, stretching up his hands to the sun. And falling face downwards on the ground, he sobbed like a little child, shaken by his tears and spreading out his arms on the ground. Then all rushed up to him. There were exclamations and sympathetic sobs. A kind of frenzy seemed to take possession of them all.
This is the one who is a saint. This is the one who is a holy man,
some cried aloud, losing their fear.
This is he who should be an elder,
others added malignantly.
He wouldn't be an elder. He would refuse. He wouldn't serve a cursed innovation. He wouldn't imitate their foolery.
Other voices chimed in at once. And it is hard to say how far they might have gone, but at that moment the bell rang, summoning them to service. All began crossing the cells at once. Father Ferapont, too, got up, and crossing himself went back to his cell without looking round, still uttering exclamations which were utterly incoherent. A few followed him, but the greater number dispersed, hastening to service. Father Paisi let Father Yosef read in his place and went down. The frantic outcries of bigots could not shake him, but his heart was suddenly filled with melancholy for some special reason, and he felt that. He stood still and suddenly wondered, "Why am I sad even to dejection?" And immediately grasped with surprise that his sudden sadness was due to a very small and special cause. In the crowd, thronging at the entrance to the cell, he had noticed Alyosha, and he remembered that he had felt at once a pang at heart on seeing him.
"Can that boy mean so much to my heart now?"
he asked himself, wondering. At that moment Alyosha passed him, hurrying away, but not in the direction of the church. Their eyes met. Alyosha quickly turned away his eyes and dropped them to the ground. And from the boy's look alone, Father Paisi guessed what a great change was taking place in him at that moment.
"Have you, too, fallen into temptation?" cried Father Paisi. "Can you be with those of little faith?" he added mournfully.
Alyosha stood still and gazed vaguely at Father Paisi, but quickly turned his eyes away again and again looked on the ground. He stood sideways and did not turn his face to Father Paisi, who watched his attentively.
"Where are you hastening? The bell calls to service," he asked again.
But again Alyosha gave no answer.
"Are you leaving the hermitage? What, without asking leave, without asking a blessing?"
Alyosha suddenly gave a wry smile, cast a strange, very strange look at the father to whom his former guide, the former sovereign of his heart and mind, his beloved elder, had confided him as he lay dying, and suddenly, still without speaking, waved his hand as though not caring even to be respectful, and with rapid steps walked towards the gates away from the hermitage.
"You will come back again,"
murmured Father Paisi, looking after him with sorrowful surprise. Chapter 2. A Critical Moment. Father Paisi, of course, was not wrong when he decided that his dear boy would come back again. Perhaps, indeed, to some extent he penetrated with insight into the true meaning of Alyosha's spiritual condition. Yet I must frankly own that it would be very difficult for me to give a clear account of that strange, vague moment in the life of the young hero I love so much. To Father Paisi's sorrowful question, "Are you too with those of little faith?" I could, of course, confidently answer for Alyosha, "No, he is not with those of little faith. Quite the contrary. Indeed, all his trouble came from the fact that he was of great faith." But still, the trouble was there, and was so agonizing that even long afterwards Alyosha thought of that sorrowful day as one of the bitterest and most fateful days of his life. If the question is asked, could all his grief and disturbance have been only due to the fact that his elder's body had shown signs of premature decomposition, instead of at once performing miracles, I must answer without beating about the bush, yes, it certainly was. I would only beg the reader not to be in too great a hurry to laugh at my young hero's pure heart. I am far from intending to apologize for him, or to justify his innocent faith on the ground of his youth, or the little progress he had made in his studies, or any such reason. I must declare, on the contrary, that I have genuine respect for the qualities of his heart. No doubt a youth who received impressions cautiously, whose love was lukewarm, and whose mind was too prudent for his age and so of little value. Such a young man might, I admit, have avoided what happened to my hero. But in some cases it is really more creditable to be carried away by an emotion, however unreasonable, which springs from a great love, than to be unmoved. And this is even truer in youth, for a young man who is always sensible is to be suspected, and is of little worth. That's my opinion. But, reasonable people will exclaim, perhaps, every young man cannot believe in such a superstition, and your hero is no model for others. To this I reply again, yes, my hero had faith, a faith holy and steadfast, but still I'm not going to apologize for him. Though I declared above, and perhaps too hastily, that I should not explain or justify my hero, I see that some explanation is necessary for the understanding of the rest of my story. Let me say, then, it was not a question of miracles. There was no frivolous and impatient expectation of miracles in his mind. And Alyosha needed no miracles at the time, for the triumph of some preconceived idea. Oh, no, not at all. What he saw before all was one figure. The figure of his beloved elder, the figure of that holy man whom he revered with such adoration. The fact is that all the love that lay concealed in his pure young heart for everyone and everything had, for the past year, been concentrated, and perhaps wrongly so, on one being, his beloved elder. It is true that being had for so long been accepted by him as his ideal, that all his young strength and energy could not but turn towards that ideal, even to the forgetting at the moment of everyone and everything. He remembered afterwards how on that terrible day he had entirely forgotten his brother Dmitri, about whom he'd been so anxious and troubled the day before. He had forgotten, too, to take the 200 rubles to Ilusha's father, though he had so warmly intended to do so the preceding evening. But again, it was not miracles he needed, but only the higher justice, which had been, in his belief, outraged by the blow that had so suddenly and cruelly wounded his heart. And what does it signify that this justice, looked for by Alyosha, inevitably took the shape of miracles to be wrought immediately by the ashes of his adored teacher? Why, everyone in the monastery cherished the same thought and the same hope. even those whose intellects Alyosha revered, Father Paisi himself, for instance. And so Alyosha, untroubled by doubts, clothed his dreams too in the same form as all the rest. And a whole year of life in the monastery had formed the habit of this expectation in his heart. But it was justice, justice he thirsted for, not simply miracles. And now the man who should, he believed, have been exalted above everyone in the whole world, that man, instead of receiving the glory that was his due, was suddenly degraded and dishonored. What for? Who had judged him? Who could have decreed this? Those were the questions that wrung his inexperienced and virginal heart. He could not endure without mortification, without resentment even, that the holiest of holy men should have been exposed to the jeering and spiteful mockery of the frivolous crowd so inferior to him. Even had there been no miracles, had there been nothing marvellous to justify his hopes, why this indignity, why this humiliation, why this premature decay in excess of nature? As the spiteful monk said, why this sign from heaven which they so triumphantly acclaimed in company with Father Ferapont? And why did they believe they had gained the right to acclaim it? Where is the finger of Providence? Why did Providence hide its face at the most critical moment? So Alyosha thought it, as though voluntarily submitting to the blind, dumb, pitiless laws of nature. That was why Alyosha's heart was bleeding, and of course, as I have said already, the sting of it all was that the man he loved above everything on earth should be put to shame and humiliated. This murmuring may have been shallow and unreasonable in my hero, but I repeat again for the third time, and am prepared to admit that it might be difficult to defend my feeling. I am glad that my hero showed himself not too reasonable at that moment, for any man of sense will always come back to reason in time. But if love does not gain the upper hand in a boy's heart at such an exceptional moment, when will it? I will not, however, omit to mention something strange, which came for a time to the surface of Alyosha's mind at this fatal and obscure moment. This new something was the harassing impression left by the conversation with Ivan, which now persistently haunted Alyosha's mind. At this moment it haunted him. Oh, it was not that something of the fundamental, elemental, so to speak, faith of his soul had been shaken. He loved his God and believed in him steadfastly, though he was suddenly murmuring against him. Yet a vague but tormenting and evil impression left by his conversation with Ivan the day before suddenly revived again now in his soul and seemed forcing its way to the surface of his consciousness. It had begun to get dark when Rakitin, crossing the pine copse from the hermitage to the monastery, suddenly noticed Alyosha lying face downwards on the ground under a tree, not moving and apparently asleep. He went up and called him by his name. "You here, Alexei? Can you have—" He began wondering, but broke off. He'd meant to say, "Can you have come to this?" Alyosha did not look at him, but from a slight movement Rakitin at once saw that he heard and understood him. "What's the matter?" he went on. But the surprise in his face gradually passed into a smile that became more and more ironical. "I say, I've been looking for you for the last 2 hours. You suddenly disappeared. What are you about? What foolery is this? You might just look at me." Alyosha raised his head, sat up and leaned his back against the tree. He was not crying, but there was a look of suffering and irritability in his face. He did not look at Rakitin, however, but looked away to one side of him. "Do you know your face is quite changed? There's none of your famous mildness to be seen in it. Are you angry with someone? Have they been ill-treating you?" "Let me alone," said Alyosha suddenly, with a weary gesture of his hand, still looking away from him. "Oho, so that's how we are feeling. So you can shout at people like other mortals. This is a come-down from the angels. I say, Alyosha, you've surprised me, do you hear? I mean it. It's long since I've been surprised at anything here. I always took you for an educated man." Alyosha at last looked at him, but vaguely, as though scarcely understanding what he said. "Can you really be so upset, simply because your old man has begun to stink? You don't mean to say you seriously believed that he was going to work miracles?" exclaimed Rakitin, genuinely surprised again. "I want to believe, and I will believe. What more do you want?" cried Alyosha irritably. "Nothing at all, my boy, damn it all. Why, no schoolboy of 13 believes in that now. But there—" "So, now you're in a temper with your God, you're rebelling against him. He hasn't given promotion. He hasn't bestowed the Order of Merit. Hey, you are a set.
Alyosha gazed a long while with his eyes half closed at Rakitin, and there was a sudden gleam in his eyes, but not of anger with Rakitin.
I'm not rebelling against my God. I simply don't accept his world.
Alyosha suddenly smiled a forced smile.
How do you mean you don't accept the world?
Rakitin thought a moment over his answer.
What idiocy is this?
Alyosha did not answer.
Come, enough nonsense. Now to business. Have you had anything to eat today?
I don't remember. I think I have.
You need keeping up, to judge by your face. It makes one sorry to look at you. You didn't sleep all night either, I hear. You had a meeting in there, and then all this bobbery afterwards. Most likely you've had nothing to eat but a mouthful of holy bread. I've got some sausage in my pocket. I've brought it from the town in case of need. Only you won't eat sausage.
Give me some.
I say, you are going it. Why, it's a regular mutiny with barricades. Well, my boy, we must make the most of it. Come to my place. I shouldn't mind a drop of vodka myself. I'm tired to death. Vodka's going too far for you, I suppose. Or would you like some?
Give me some vodka, too.
Hello, you surprise me, brother.
Rakitin looked at him in amazement.
Well, one way or another, vodka or sausage, this is a jolly fine chance and mustn't be missed. Come along.
Alyosha got up in silence and followed Rakitin.
If your little brother Ivan could see this, wouldn't he be surprised? By the way, your brother Ivan set off to Moscow this morning, did you know?
Yes,
answered Alyosha listlessly, and suddenly the image of his brother Dmitri rose before his mind. But only for a minute, and though it reminded him of something that must not be put off for a moment, some duty, some terrible obligation. Even that reminder made no impression on him, did not reach his heart, and instantly faded out of his mind and was forgotten. But a long while afterwards, Alyosha remembered this.
Your brother Ivan declared once that I was a liberal booby with no talents whatever. Once you, too, could not resist letting me know I was dishonourable. Well, I should like to see what your talents and sense of honour will do for you now.
This phrase Rakitin finished to himself in a whisper.
Listen, he said aloud, let's go by the path beyond the monastery straight to the town. I ought to go to Madame Holokoff's, by the way. Only fancy, I've written to tell her everything that happened, and would you believe it, she answered me instantly in pencil. The lady has a passion for writing notes, that she would never have expected such conduct from a man of such a reverend character as Father Zosima. That was her very word, conduct. She's angry, too. Hey, you are a set. Stay,
he cried suddenly again. He suddenly stopped, and taking Alyosha by the shoulder, made him stop, too.
Do you know, Alyosha?
He peeped inquisitively in his eyes, absorbed in a sudden new thought which had dawned on him. And though he was laughing outwardly, he was evidently afraid to utter that new idea aloud. So difficult, he still found it to believe, in the strange and unexpected mood in which he now saw Alyosha.
Alyosha, do you know where we'd better go?
He brought out at last timidly and insinuatingly.
I don't care. Where you like.
Let's go to Grushenka, eh? Will you come?
Pronounced Rakitin at last, trembling with timid suspense.
Let's go to Grushenka,
Alyosha answered calmly, at once. And this prompt and calm agreement was such a surprise to Rakitin that he almost started back.
Well, I say,
he cried in amazement. But seizing Alyosha firmly by the arm, he led him along the path, still dreading that he would change his mind. They walked along in silence. Rakitin was positively afraid to talk.
And how glad you will be, how delighted,
he muttered, but lapsed into silence again. And, indeed, it was not to please Grushenka he was taking Alyosha to her. He was a practical person and never undertook anything without a prospect of gain for himself. His object in this case was twofold. First, a revengeful desire to see the downfall of the righteous, and Alyosha's fall from the saints to the sinners, over which he was already gloating in his imagination. And in the second place, he had in view a certain material gain for himself, of which more will be said later.
So, the critical moment has come, he thought to himself with spiteful glee, and we shall catch it on the hop, for it's just what we want.
Chapter 3 An Onion Grushenka lived in the busiest part of the town, near the cathedral square, in a small wooden lodge in the courtyard belonging to the house of the widow Morozov.
The house was a large stone building of two stories, old and very ugly. The widow led a secluded life with her two unmarried nieces, who were also elderly women. She had no need to let her lodge, but everyone knew that she'd taken in Grushenka as a lodger 4 years before, solely to please her kinsman, the merchant Samsonov, who was known to be the girl's protector. It was said that the jealous old man's object in placing his favourite with the widow Morozov was that the old woman should keep a sharp eye on her new lodger's conduct. But this sharp eye soon proved to be unnecessary, and in the end the widow Morozov seldom met Grushenka and did not worry her by looking after her in any way. It is true that 4 years had passed since the old man had brought the slim, delicate, shy, timid, dreamy, and sad girl of 18 from the chief town of the province, and much had happened since then. Little was known of the girl's history in the town, and that little was vague. Nothing more had been learned during the last 4 years, even after many persons had become interested in the beautiful young woman into whom Agrafena Alexandrovna had meanwhile developed. There were rumours that she had been at 17 betrayed by someone, some sort of officer, and immediately afterwards abandoned by him. The officer had gone away and afterwards married, while Grushenka had been left in poverty and disgrace. It was said, however, that though Grushenka had been raised from destitution by the old man, Samsonov, she came of a respectable family belonging to the clerical class, that she was the daughter of a deacon or something of the sort. And now, after 4 years, the sensitive, injured, and pathetic little orphan had become a plump, rosy beauty of the Russian type, a woman of bold and determined character, proud and insolent. She had a good head for business, was acquisitive, saving, and careful, and by fair means or foul had succeeded, it was said, in amassing a little fortune. There was only one point on which all were agreed. Grushenka was not easily to be approached, and except her aged protector, there had not been one man who could boast of her favours during those 4 years. It was a positive fact, for there had been a good many, especially during the last 2 years, who had attempted to obtain those favours. But all their efforts had been in vain, and some of these suitors had been forced to beat an undignified and even comic retreat, owing to the firm and ironical resistance they met from the strong-willed young person. It was known, too, that the young person had, especially of late, been given to what is called speculation, and that she had shown marked abilities in that direction, so that many people began to say that she was no better than a Jew. It was not that she lent money on interest, but it was known, for instance, that she had for some time past, in partnership with old Karamazov, actually invested in the purchase of bad debts for a trifle, a tenth of their nominal value, and afterwards had made out of them 10 times their value. The old widower Samsonov, a man of large fortune, was stingy and merciless. He tyrannized over his grown-up sons, but for the last year during which he'd been ill and lost the use of his swollen legs, he had fallen greatly under the influence of his protégé, whom he had at first kept strictly and in humble surroundings, on Lenten fare, as the wits said at the time. But Grushenka had succeeded in emancipating herself while she established in him a boundless belief in her fidelity. The old man, now long since dead, had had a large business in his day, and was also a noteworthy character, miserly and hard as flint. Though Grushenka's hold upon him was so strong that he could not live without her, it had been so especially for the last 2 years, he did not settle any considerable fortune on her, and would not have been moved to do so if she had threatened to leave him. But he had presented her with a small sum, and even that was a surprise to everyone when it became known. "You are a wench with brains," he said to her when he gave her 8,000 rubles, "and you must look after yourself. But let me tell you that except your yearly allowance as before, you'll get nothing more from me to the day of my death, and I'll leave you nothing in my will either." And he kept his word. He died and left everything to his sons, whom, with their wives and children, he had treated all his life as servants. Grushenka was not even mentioned in his will. All this became known afterwards. He helped Grushenka with his advice to increase her capital and put business in her way. When Fyodor Pavlovich, who first came into contact with Grushenka over a piece of speculation, ended to his own surprise by falling madly in love with her, Old Samsonov, gravely ill as he was immensely amused. It is remarkable that throughout their whole acquaintance, Grushenka was absolutely and spontaneously open with the old man, and he seems to have been the only person in the world with whom she was so. Of late, when Dmitri too had come on the scene with his love, the old man left off laughing. On the contrary, he once gave Grushenka a stern and earnest piece of advice.
"If you have to choose between the two, father or son, you better choose the old man, if only you make sure the old scoundrel will marry you and settle some fortune on you beforehand. But don't keep on with the captain, you'll get no good out of that."
These were the very words of the old profligate, who felt already that his death was not far off, and who actually died 5 months later. I will note, too, in passing, that although many in our town knew of the grotesque and monstrous rivalry of the Karamazovs, father and son, the object of which was Grushenka, scarcely anyone understood what really underlay her attitude to both of them. Even Grushenka's two servants, after the catastrophe of which we will speak later, testified in court that she received Dmitri Fyodorovitch simply from fear because he threatened to murder her. These servants were an old cook, invalidish and almost deaf, who came from Grushenka's old home, and her granddaughter, a smart young girl of 20, who performed the duties of a maid. Grushenka lived very economically, and her surroundings were anything but luxurious. Her lodge consisted of three rooms, furnished with mahogany furniture in the fashion of 1820, belonging to her landlady. It was quite dark when Rakitin and Alyosha entered her rooms, yet they were not lighted up. Grushenka was lying down in her drawing room on the big, hard, clumsy sofa, with a mahogany back. The sofa was covered with shabby and ragged leather. Under her head she had two white down pillows taken from her bed. She was lying, stretched out motionless on her back, with her hands behind her head. She was dressed as though expecting someone, in a black silk dress, with a dainty lace fichu on her head, which was very becoming. Over her shoulders was thrown a lace shawl pinned with a massive gold brooch. She certainly was expecting someone. She lay, as though impatient and weary, her face rather pale and her lips and eyes hot, restlessly tapping the arm of the sofa with the tip of her right foot. The appearance of Rakitin and Alyosha caused a slight excitement. From the hall they could hear Grushenka leap up from the sofa and cry out in a frightened voice, "Who's there?" But the maid met the visitors and at once called back to her mistress.
"It's not he, it's nothing, only other visitors."
"What can be the matter?" muttered Rakitin, leading Alyosha into the drawing room.
Grushenka was standing by the sofa as though still alarmed. A thick coil of her dark brown hair escaped from its lace covering and fell on her right shoulder. But she did not notice it, and did not put it back till she gazed at her visitors and recognized them.
"Ah, it's you, Rakitin. You quite frightened me. Whom have you brought? Who is this with you? Good heavens, you've brought him!"
she exclaimed, recognizing Alyosha.
"Do send for candles,"
said Rakitin, with the free and easy air of a most intimate friend, who is privileged to give orders in the house.
"Candles, of course, candles. Fenya, fetch him a candle. Well, you have chosen a moment to bring him,"
she exclaimed again, nodding towards Alyosha and turning to the looking-glass. She began quickly fastening up her hair with both hands. She seemed displeased.
"Haven't I managed to please you?"
asked Rakitin, instantly almost offended.
"You frighten me, Rakitin, that's what it is."
Grushenka turned with a smile to Alyosha.
"Don't be afraid of me, my dear Alyosha. You can't think how glad I am to see you, my unexpected visitor. But you frighten me, Rakitin. I thought it was Mitya breaking in. You see, I deceived him just now. I made him promise to believe me, and I told him a lie. I told him that I was going to spend the evening with my old man, Kuzma Kuzmich, and should be there till late, counting up his money. I always spend one whole evening a week with him, making up his accounts. We lock ourselves in, and he counts on the reckoning beads while I sit and put things down in the book. I'm the only person he trusts. Mitya believes that I'm there, but I came back and have been sitting locked in here, expecting some news. How was it Fenya let you in? Fenya, Fenya, run out to the gate, open it, and look about whether the captain is to be seen. Perhaps he's hiding and spying. I'm dreadfully frightened. There's no one there, Agrafena Alexandrovna. I've just looked out. I keep running to peep through the crack. I'm in fear and trembling myself. Are the shutters fastened, Fenya? And we must draw the curtains. That's better.
She drew the heavy curtains herself.
He'd rush in at once if he saw a light. I'm afraid of your brother Mitya today, Alyosha.
Grushenka spoke aloud, and though she was alarmed, she seemed very happy about something.
Why are you so afraid of Mitya today? Inquired Rakitin. I should have thought you were not timid with him. You'd twist him round your little finger.
I tell you I'm expecting news, priceless news, so I don't want Mitya at all. And he didn't believe, I feel he didn't, that I should stay at Kuzma Kuzmich's. He must be in his ambush now behind Fyodor Pavlovich's in the garden, watching for me. And if he's there, he won't come here, so much the better. But I really have been to Kuzma Kuzmich's. Mitya escorted me there. I told him I should stay there till midnight, and I asked him to be sure to come at midnight to fetch me home. He went away, and I sat 10 minutes with Kuzma Kuzmich and came back here again. Oh, I was afraid. I ran for fear of meeting him.
And why are you so dressed up? What a curious cap you've got on.
How curious you are yourself, Rakitin. I tell you, I'm expecting a message. If the message comes, I shall fly. I shall gallop away, and you will see no more of me. That's why I'm dressed up, so as to be ready.
And where are you flying to?
If you know too much, you'll get old too soon.
Upon my word, you are highly delighted. I've never seen you like this before. You're dressed up as if you were going to a ball.
Rakitin looked her up and down.
Much you know about balls.
And do you know much about them?
I have seen a ball the year before last, Kuzma Kuzmich's son was married, and I looked on from the gallery. Do you suppose I want to be talking to you, Rakitin, while a prince like this is standing here? Such a visitor! Alyosha, my dear boy, I gaze at you and can't believe my eyes. Good heavens! Can you have come here to see me? To tell you the truth, I never had a thought of seeing you, and I didn't think that you would ever come and see me. Though this is not the moment now, I'm awfully glad to see you. Sit down on the sofa here, that's right, my bright young moon. I really can't take it in even now. Hey, Rakitin, if only you'd brought him yesterday or the day before. But I am glad as it is. Perhaps it's better he has come now at such a moment, and not the day before yesterday.
She gaily sat down beside Alyosha on the sofa, looking at him with positive delight. And she really was glad. She was not lying when she said so. Her eyes glowed, her lips laughed. But it was a good-natured, merry laugh. Alyosha had not expected to see such a kind expression in her face. He had hardly met her till the day before. He'd formed an alarming idea of her, and had been horribly distressed the day before by the spiteful and treacherous trick she'd played on Katerina Ivanovna. He was greatly surprised to find her now altogether different from what he'd expected. And, crushed as he was by his own sorrow, his eyes involuntarily rested on her with attention. Her whole manner seemed changed for the better since yesterday. There was scarcely any trace of that mawkish sweetness in her speech, of that voluptuous softness in her movements. Everything was simple and good-natured. Her gestures were rapid, direct, confiding. But she was greatly excited.
"Dear me, how everything comes together today," she chattered on again. "And why I'm so glad to see you, Alyosha, I couldn't say myself. If you ask me, I couldn't tell you."
"Come, don't you know why you're glad?" said Rakitin, grinning. "You used to be always pestering me to bring him. You'd some object, I suppose."
"I had a different object once, but now that's over. This is not the moment. I say, I want you to have something nice. I'm so good-natured now. You sit down too, Rakitin. Why are you standing?" "You've sat down already. There's no fear of Rakitin's forgetting to look after himself. Look, Alyosha, he's sitting there opposite us, so offended that I didn't ask him to sit down before you. Oh, Rakitin is such a one to take offence," laughed Grushenka. "Don't be angry, Rakitin. I'm kind today. Why are you so depressed, Alyosha? Are you afraid of me?"
She peeped into his eyes with merry mockery.
"He's sad. The promotion has not been given,"
boomed Rakitin.
"What promotion?"
"His elder stinks."
"What? You're talking some nonsense. You want to say something nasty. Be quiet, you stupid. Let me sit on your knee, Alyosha, like this."
She suddenly skipped forward and jumped, laughing on his knees, like a nestling kitten with her right arm about his neck.
"I'll cheer you up, my pious boy." "Yes, really, will you let me sit on your knee? You won't be angry. If you tell me, I'll get off."
Alyosha did not speak. He sat, afraid to move. He heard her words, "If you tell me, I'll get off." But he did not answer. But there was nothing in his heart such as Rakitin, for instance, watching him malignantly from his corner, might have expected or fancied. The great grief in his heart swallowed up every sensation that might have been aroused, and if only he could have thought clearly at that moment, he would have realized that he had now the strongest armor to protect him from every lust and temptation. Yet in spite of the vague irresponsiveness of his spiritual condition, and the sorrow that overwhelmed him, he could not help wondering at a new and strange sensation in his heart. This woman, this dreadful woman, had no terror for him now, none of that terror that had stirred in his soul at any passing thought of woman. On the contrary, this woman, dreaded above all women, sitting now on his knee, holding him in her arms, aroused in him now a quite different, unexpected, peculiar feeling, a feeling of the intensest and purest interest, without a trace of fear, of his former terror. That was what instinctively surprised him. "You've talked nonsense enough," cried Rakitin. "You much better give us some champagne. You owe it me. You know you do."
"Yes, I really do. Do you know, Alyosha, I promised him champagne on the top of everything if he'd bring you. I'll have some too. Fenya, bring us the bottle Mitya left. Look sharp. Though I am so stingy, I'll stand a bottle. Not for you, Rakitin, you're a toadstool, but he is a falcon. And though my heart is full of something very different, so be it, I'll drink with you. I long for some dissipation."
"But what's the matter with you, and what is this message, may I ask, or is it a secret?" Rakitin put in inquisitively, doing his best to pretend not to notice the snubs that were being continually aimed at him.
"Eh, it's not a secret, and you know it too,"
Grushenka said in a voice suddenly anxious, turning her head towards Rakitin and drawing a little away from Alyosha, though she still sat on his knee with her arm round his neck.
"My officer is coming, Rakitin. My officer is coming."
"I heard he was coming, but is he so near?"
"He's at Mokroe now. He'll send a messenger from there, so he wrote. I got a letter from him today. I'm expecting the messenger every minute."
"You don't say so. Why at Mokroe?"
"That's a long story. I've told you enough."
"Mitya'll be up to something now. I say, does he know or doesn't he?"
"He? No, of course he doesn't. If he knew, there'd be murder. But I'm not afraid of that now. I'm not afraid of his knife. Be quiet, Rakitin. Don't remind me of Dmitri Fyodorovitch. He has bruised my heart, and I don't want to think of that at this moment. I can think of Alyosha here. I can look at Alyosha. Smile at me, dear. Cheer up. Smile at my foolishness, at my pleasure. Ah, he's smiling. He's smiling. How kindly he looks at me. And you know, Alyosha, I've been thinking all this time you were angry with me, because of the day before yesterday, because of that young lady. I was a cur, that's the truth. But it's a good thing it happened so. It was a horrid thing, but a good thing too."
Grushenka smiled dreamily, and a little cruel line showed in her smile.
"Mitya told me that she screamed out that I ought to be flogged. I did insult her dreadfully. She sent for me. She wanted to make a conquest of me, to win me over with her chocolate. No, it's a good thing it did end like that." She smiled again. "But I'm still afraid of your being angry."
"Yes, that's really true," Rakitin put in suddenly with genuine surprise. "Alyosha, she is really afraid of a chicken like you."
"He's a chicken to you, Rakitin, because you've no conscience, that's what it is. You see, I love him with all my soul, that's how it is. Alyosha, do you believe I love you with all my soul?"
"Ah, you shameless woman, she's making you a declaration, Alexei."
"Well, what of it? I love him."
"And what about your officer and the priceless message from Mokroe?"
"That's quite different."
"That's a woman's way of looking at it."
"Don't you make me angry, Rakitin." Grushenka caught him up hotly. "This is quite different. I love Alyosha in a different way. It's true, Alyosha, I had sly designs on you before, for I am a horrid, violent creature. But at other times I've looked upon you, Alyosha, as my conscience. I've kept thinking how anyone like that must despise a nasty thing like me. I thought that the day before yesterday as I ran home from the young ladies. I've thought of you a long time in that way, Alyosha, and Mitya knows. I've talked to him about it. Mitya understands. Would you believe it? I sometimes look at you and feel ashamed, utterly ashamed of myself. And how, and since when, I began to think about you like that, I can't say. I don't remember.
Fenya came in and put a tray with an uncorked bottle and three glasses of champagne on the table. "Here's the champagne," cried Rakitin. "You're excited, Agrafena Alexandrovna, and not yourself. When you've had a glass of champagne, you'll be ready to dance. Eh? They can't even do that properly," he added, looking at the bottle. "The old woman's poured it out in the kitchen, and the bottle's been brought in warm and without a cork. Well, let me have some, anyway."
He went up to the table, took a glass, emptied it at one gulp, and poured himself out another.
"One doesn't often stumble upon champagne," he said, licking his lips. "Now, Alyosha, take a glass, show what you can do. What shall we drink to? The gates of paradise? Take a glass, Grushenka. You drink to the gates of paradise, too."
"What gates of paradise?"
She took a glass. Alyosha took his, tasted it, and put it back.
"No, I'd better not."
He smiled gently. "And you bragged," cried Rakitin.
"Well, if so, I won't either," chimed in Grushenka. "I really don't want any. You can drink the whole bottle alone, Rakitin. If Alyosha has some, I will."
"What touching sentimentality," said Rakitin tauntingly. "And she's sitting on his knee, too. He's got something to grieve over, but what's the matter with you? He's rebelling against his God and ready to eat sausage."
"How so?"
"His elder died today, Father Zosima, the saint."
"So, Father Zosima is dead," cried Grushenka. "Good God, I did not know." She crossed herself devoutly. "Goodness, what have I been doing sitting on his knee like this at such a moment?"
She started up, as though in dismay. Instantly he slipped off his knee and sat down on the sofa. Alyosha bent a long, wondering look upon her, and the light seemed to dawn in his face.
"Rakitin," he said suddenly in a firm and loud voice, "don't taunt me with having rebelled against God. I don't want to feel angry with you, so you must be kinder too. I've lost a treasure such as you have never had, and you cannot judge me now. You'd much better look at her. Do you see how she has pity on me? I came here to find a wicked soul. I felt drawn to evil because I was base and evil myself. And I found a true sister, I found a treasure, a loving heart. She had pity on me just now. Agrafena Alexandrovna, I'm speaking of you. You've raised my soul from the depths."
Alyosha's lips were quivering, and he caught his breath. "She has saved you, it seems," laughed Rakitin spitefully. "And she meant to get you in her clutches, do you realize that?"
"Stay, Rakitin," Grushenka jumped up. "Hush, both of you. Now I'll tell you all about it. Hush, Alyosha, your words make me ashamed, for I'm bad and not good. That's what I am. And you hush, Rakitin, because you're telling lies. I had the low idea of trying to get him in my clutches. But now you're lying, now it's all different. And don't let me hear anything more from you, Rakitin."
All this Grushenka said with extreme emotion. "They're both crazy," said Rakitin, looking at them with amazement. "I feel as though I'm in a madhouse. They're both getting so feeble, they'll begin crying in a minute."
"I shall begin to cry. I shall," repeated Grushenka. "He called me a sister, and I shall never forget that. Only let me tell you, Rakitin, though I am bad, I did give away an onion."
"An onion? Hang it all, you really are crazy."
Rakitin wondered at their enthusiasm. He was aggrieved and annoyed, though he might have reflected that each of them was just passing through a spiritual crisis, such as does not come often in a lifetime. But though Rakitin was very sensitive about everything that concerned himself, he was very obtuse as regards the feelings and sensations of others, partly from his youth and inexperience, partly from his intense egoism. "You see, Alyosha," Grushenka turned to him with a nervous laugh, "I was boasting when I told Rakitin I'd given away an onion. But it's not to boast I tell you about it. It's only a story, but it's a nice story. I used to hear it when I was a child from Matryona, my cook, who was still with me. It's like this. Once upon a time there was a peasant woman, and a very wicked woman she was, and she died, and did not leave a single good deed behind. The devils caught her and plunged her into the lake of fire. So her guardian angel stood and wondered what good deed of hers he could remember to tell to God. "She once pulled up an onion in her garden," said he, "and gave it to a beggar woman." And God answered, "You take that onion then, hold it out to her in the lake, and let her take hold and be pulled out. And if you can pull her out of the lake, let her come to paradise. But if the onion breaks, then the woman must stay where she is." The angel ran to the woman and held out the onion to her. "Come," said he, "catch hold and I'll pull you out." And he began cautiously pulling her out. He had just pulled her right out, when the other sinners in the lake, seeing how she was being drawn out, began catching hold of her so as to be pulled out with her. But she was a very wicked woman, and she began kicking them. "I'm to be pulled out, not you. It's my onion, not yours." As soon as she said that, the onion broke, and the woman fell into the lake, and she's burning there to this day. So the angel wept and went away. So that's the story, Alyosha. I know it by heart, for I am that wicked woman myself. I boasted to Rakitin that I'd given away an onion, but to you I'll say, I've done nothing but give away one onion all my life. That's the only good deed I've done. So don't praise me, Alyosha. Don't think me good. I am bad. I'm a wicked woman, and you make me ashamed if you praise me. Hey, I must confess everything. Listen, Alyosha, I was so anxious to get hold of you that I promised Rakitin 25 rubles if he would bring you to me. Stay, Rakitin, wait.
She went with rapid steps to the table, opened a drawer, pulled out a purse, and took from it a 25-ruble note.
"What nonsense! What nonsense!"
cried Rakitin, disconcerted.
"Take it, Rakitin. I owe it to you. There's no fear of your refusing it. You asked for it yourself."
And she threw the note to him.
"Likely I should refuse it,"
boomed Rakitin, obviously abashed, but carrying off his confusion with a swagger.
"That will come in very handy. Fools are made for wise men's profit."
"And now hold your tongue, Rakitin. What am I going to say now is not for your ears. Sit down in that corner and keep quiet. You don't like us, so hold your tongue."
"What should I like you for?"
Rakitin snarled, not concealing his ill humour. He put the 25-ruble note in his pocket, and he felt ashamed at Alyosha's seeing it. He had reckoned on receiving his payment later without Alyosha's knowing of it, and now, feeling ashamed, he lost his temper. Till that moment he had thought it discreet not to contradict Grushenka too flatly in spite of her snubbing, since he had something to get out of her. But now he, too, was angry.
"One loves people for some reason. What have either of you done for me?"
"You should love people without a reason, as Alyosha does."
"How does he love you? How has he shown it that you make such a fuss about it?"
Grushenka was standing in the middle of the room. She spoke with heat, and there were hysterical notes in her voice.
"Hush, Rakitin, you know nothing about us, and don't dare to speak to me like that again. How dare you be so familiar? Sit in that corner and be quiet as though you were my footman. And now, Alyosha, I'll tell you the whole truth, that you may see what a wretch I am. I'm not talking to Rakitin, but to you. I wanted to ruin you, Alyosha, that's the holy truth. I quite meant to. I wanted to so much that I bribed Rakitin to bring you. And why did I want to do such a thing? You knew nothing about it, Alyosha. You turned away from me. If you passed me, you dropped your eyes. And I've looked at you 100 times before today. I began asking everyone about you. Your face haunted my heart. He despises me, I thought. He won't even look at me. And I felt it so much at last that I wondered at myself for being so frightened of a boy. I'll get him in my clutches and laugh at him. I was full of spite and anger. Would you believe it? Nobody here dares talk or think of coming to Agrafena Alexandrovna with any evil purpose. Old Kuzma is the only man I have anything to do with here. I was bound and sold to him. Satan brought us together. But there has been no one else. But looking at you, I thought, I'll get him in my clutches and laugh at him. You see what a spiteful cur I am. and you called me your sister. And now that man who wronged me has come. I sit here waiting for a message from him.